I want to congratulate you on your 36th recording, which is remarkable in and of itself. And I just have this vision of you, you know, like you're either on the road or you're in the recording studio. And when do you get any downtime?
Oh, well, that would be boring. And in fact, you know, Sir Neville Mariner was the conductor who was originally going to do this album with me, and we had gone through the scores together, and then sadly he passed away right before the session, and yeah. I was so grateful that Andrew Litton was able to step in and do such a wonderful job. But, you know, Sir Neville is, of course, a hero for his great artistry and everything else, but just his energy, and I was so privileged to get to know him at the end of his life, and, you know, he was in his 90s and still, you know, living this same, you know, existence, you know, a different city every week and going. And I thought, yeah. Isn't that awesome? Like, I never want to stop.
Emulate that. Well, you bring up that the fact that you and Sir Neville were going to make this recording together. You did that wonderful Mozart album, and then you planned this recording, which is an interesting juxtaposition of works. They're both very romantic works, but they're both very different from each other. And I didn't realize this, but you have in the program notes that you've paired like the shortest romantic work for violin or orchestra with the longest romantic work.
Yeah, well, I mean, of the standard, you know, popular yeah. romantic concertos anyway, definitely the shortest and the longest. So that kind of almost joined them together in my mind. But really, it was first sparked by a reissue of the classic Menuhin interpretations from the beginning of his career, yeah. which, of course, were recorded in different years and on 78s and, you know, never conceived of together, but on the CD reissue, they did live on the same disc. So that kind of made me think, oh, Elgar Brook. And there's something about the warm, you know, rich personal sound that you need to get for both concertos that also made them feel like there was some kind of a connection there.
Yeah. I think it's interesting that, you know, this Elgar violin concerto, which I really didn't know all that well. So this is a great chance to get reacquainted with it. And I think for a lot of our listeners, maybe to introduce them to it for the first time, because they may know and love the cello concerto of Elgar. That seems to get a lot of attention.
Yeah.
But not as many people know this violin concerto. And it's a remarkable work, originally written for Fritz Kreisler, right?
Absolutely. Well, Kreisler considered it to be one of, you know, the next great concerto after, you know, Beethoven and Brahms and so on.
Yeah.
And I don't disagree. You know, it's interesting, like Dvorak, his violin concerto is absolutely lovely, but his cello concerto is, you know, a masterpiece, and the violin concerto isn't quite in that realm. It's really not true about the Elgar violin concerto, and it's not that it's a lesser work that it's less often heard. The cello concerto is shorter, so it's easier to program, and it's also more immediately accessible. You know, you kind of hear it and you can understand what's going on. The violin concerto, you just have to get to know a little bit, and it's a little more complex, but in a way, once you do get to know it, it's even more rewarding than the cello concerto. And Elgar himself considered it to be one of the favorite of his own works, and even asked that one of the melodies of the second movement be inscribed on his tombstone, if you can imagine.
Yeah.
So, I'm so excited to, you know, not only share my interpretation, but also hopefully to introduce it to some people and maybe help contribute to it getting played more often.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting in listening to it. Every once in a while I hear a little turn of phrase or a little snippet of music that reminds me of the Enigma Variations, which came like 10 or 12 years before this piece. And as we know, Elgar loved all these little puzzles and things like that. And can you tell us about this inscription that he wrote, saying that, you know, here's yeah. the soul
herein,
of, yeah.
Yeah, herein is enshrined the soul of dot, 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 dot. Yeah, he wanted to leave everybody with a mystery. And, you know, unlike the Alban Berg concerto, where people have been able to definitively, you know, discover, you know, all of the women, plural, that are buried within the notes. Elgar is still a matter for speculation. You know, he had, it doesn't appear that he was unfaithful in his marriage, but he definitely had muses, you know, women with whom he had deep emotional connections who inspired his composing, you know, along the way. And, you know, there are various of these that are put forward as possible contenders, early loves, all kinds of different things. And, you know, in the end, what does it really matter, you know? But I think just the fact that he's indicating that there's something very personal about this music, I think that's what the takeaway that is really relevant. And, you know, there's also a sort of an analysis of the first movement that various of the intertwining themes represent the masculine and feminine in dialogue. And, you know, a musicologist first put that forward during Elgar's lifetime, and Elgar, as the story goes, did not dispute it. So
he can neither confirm nor deny, right?
Something. Well, I think he would have denied had he disagreed. So, yeah. So it's very, very interesting. And of course, what he does with the cadenza in the last movement is just from a pure musical perspective is absolutely fascinating. He has he was inspired by the wind chimes in his summer home to do this strummy thing with the violins in pizzicato on their strings, and nobody had ever made that particular effect with an orchestra before.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's so fascinating that was first brought, you know, forth, not in a symphony or something, but in a violin concerto and in an accompanied cadenza.
It's so interesting, and I did not know that about the wind chimes, but I wondered where those sounds were coming from. And I know that you are the type of musician who does a lot of research and puts a lot of thought into the background of a work before you pick it up and work on it. How long have you been playing this Elgar concerto? I know the Bruch concerto, which I want to ask you about in a minute, is one of the, you know, earliest that you picked up. But how long have you been working with the Elgar?
Well, exactly. So the Bruch, you know, like many kids, it was the first major romantic concerto that I learned, because first you would learn student concertos and Baroque and classical period concertos. But then at a certain point, it was like, okay, time for the Bruch is a big moment, you know, when you feel like you've really grown up as much as one can feel like that at age 8. But after learning, you know, all the obvious, you know, normal concertos that one has to know, you know, I'd never gone through the Elgar during my student years. It never sort of came up as one of the ones that I had studied. And so it was as a young adult, you know, at the beginning of my career that I was invited to perform it. And I had owned the score and everything. And so it was a great chance to just start to get to know it. And boy, it's been quite the journey. I mean, this is just such an amazing work. And so dense with detail. It's one of the most frequent uses of speeding up and slowing down, all these little subtleties that Elgar wants you to do. And at first, it just feels like you're playing the music, you know, like you're trying to keep up with, you know, doing all of the instructions correctly. And it takes a while for it to internalize and feel natural, like, you know, like the music is finally playing you.
Yeah, interesting. Can you talk a little bit about your collaboration with Andrew Litton, who came on board after Sir Neville passed?
Yeah, well, I mean, he was absolutely terrific, of course, you know, such an experienced, I forget how many hundreds of CDs he's already made, it's unbelievable. Yeah. But, you know, he's so warm and friendly. And there was a great rapport with the producer, Andrew Keener, who had also produced my Mozart album with Sir Neville, because it turns out that Andrew Keener and Andrew Litton were old friends. In fact, the one Andrew had been the best man at the other Andrew's wedding. And so there is just a lot of, you know, history there and a lot of, you know, jokes in the control room and, you know, really put everybody at ease. And that was so cool. But I loved that, you know, not every great conductor likes accompanying, you know, because then you're not the one and only star of the interpretation. And, you know, Sir Neville was always so generous in trying to, you know, in his collaborations and honoring my ideas. And Andrew Litton also was just absolutely wonderful to work with. And then when he did have his tutti moments, there's one in the first movement of the Bruch in particular where he had very strong ideas about how the orchestra bit should be shaped, you know, the bit where I don't play and it's just the orchestra. Mm-hmm. And it was so great that he brought so much care, you know, because a lot of conductors might have just, you know, gone through it and, you know, done it in a reasonable kind of normal way. But he was like, no, we're going to make this special. And it really is.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about that Baruch concerto. Everybody knows that violin concerto number one. He also wrote some other works for the violin, which are not.
Yeah,
as
in
well
fact,
known.
He kind of resented that he, you know, at the end of his life, he sort of had already become a bit of a one-hit wonder, even though he did write so much other good stuff, and he almost came to sort of resent this concerto as overshadowing all his other pieces. But it's understandable because it is so glorious.
Yeah. Now, you picked this up and played it when you were 8 years old, is that right?
Yes. Yes, that's right.
How did that happen?
Well, my teacher assigned it, but you know, I knew it was on the horizon because that is, you know, it's certainly not a, you know, there's nothing immature about it. There's nothing easy about it, really. It's just that it doesn't have the level of pyrotechnics or stamina that other concertos demand. I mean, you, no matter how advanced a little kid would be, you would never give an 8-year-old the Brahms concerto because there's just a depth of emotional understanding that, you know, no child in their single digits could possess. You know, playing the notes is the least of it. So the Baruch is a little bit more just this warm, rich, you know, beautiful sound. And, you know, it's got, you know, sort of anger in the first movement and triumph in the last movement and, you know, epic soaring quality in the second movement. And it's definitely something that a little kid can get their mind around. But what I love about it is that, you know, and one of the reasons it is such a great masterpiece is that you can continually find more in it every time you return to it. I don't think I'll ever get bored with it, no matter how many times I play it, because it's just endlessly rewarding.
I imagine that you've discovered a few things since you were 8 years old working on that.
I would hope so.
I love how you call both of these works an indulgence in romanticism. And they kind of go in different directions, but they're both very romantic. And I think Elgar even himself said it was a little too emotional for him when he was talking about it being his favorite.
Yeah, well, you know, it was very, very personal, and he had this mysterious dedication, you know, the herein is enshrined the soul of ... And so, you know, the whole thing is just so deeply personal, almost like a confessional in a way.
Yeah.
And but I think that's what makes it so special and such a challenge for the performer. You know, there are some concerto, like the Brahms is about, you know, the majesty of creation. It's very lofty, but, you know, you're almost putting the piece on a pedestal, and, you know, it's not as much about, like, the inward human emotions, if you know what I mean. And this piece is, you know, very epic, but still at the same time very inward, and so you really have to get in touch with yourself and your own feelings in order to get inside the feelings that Elgar was expressing.
Yeah, you can really hear that. Well, I know listeners here in the Toledo area will remember your performance of Brahms last October with the Toledo Symphony, so I hope that they'll go out and pick up this album. Rachel Barton Pine, violinist, the Elgar and Baruch Violin Concertos. Rachel, if folks want to catch up with you on social media, what's the best way to do that?
Oh, of course, I've got my website, and I'm on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, all the usual stuff. Got a YouTube channel, so and a podcast, Violin Adventures. I haven't contributed new episodes since my daughter got going with the violin, and I turned into a daily practicing parent. but there are, you know, 70 or 80 old episodes with all kinds of fun stuff, and who knows, maybe one of these days I'll get back to it.
Great. Well, we'll post all of that on our website at WGTE.org. Again, Rachel, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Take care.